Now we know it's maybe not so rare. That's also a good story. But ultimately, that non-genuine change, it doesn't tell us about what has happened to that dragonfly population in the last 10 years, because presumably it was already present in this new population. So by isolating the genuine changes and kind of peeling back the layers of non-genuine changes, we can really start to see what is actually happening to biodiversity in BC on this large scale. And when we peel back the hundreds of non-genuine changes and isolate the relatively few genuine changes in either direction, we find that the most common outcome for species in BC is no change, is that they remain red listed species, remain red listed, blue listed species remain blue listed, and so on. By far, the most common outcome is that things are staying the same. And once again, that can be thought of as a good story, but it also means that these species that we knew were at risk 10 years ago are still in trouble.
That was an excerpt from a new episode of The Environment in Canada. Find it at sierraclub.ca and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Over 900 episodes since 2016, Free City Radio with host Stéphane Christophe in Montreal has explored the intersection of social activism and the arts in a weekly program featuring interviews with creative voices involved in struggles for transformative social change. On this highlight from a recent episode, author and educator Pasha Mala explores Canada in the context of global political crisis and the importance of challenging political complacency in a time of rising extreme right politics. Now, here's Stéphane.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. This is edition 286, and I'm Stéphane Christophe. Thanks for tuning in. On the broadcast this week, I am going to be featuring a conversation with writer and author Pasha Mala. Pasha is an educator working at York University in Toronto in the creative writing program, and also a commentator writing articles for numerous publications in Canada. I spoke with Pasha about this political moment in Canada, the reality of a rising extreme right politics, how that intersects with the liberal center that has been speaking progressive language in many respects over recent years. But when analysis comes down, looking at their policies, we don't see that language matched by the policies of successive liberal governments in terms of impacts on working people's lives. And so that political space between language, rhetoric, and policy is being exploited by the right. We talk about this. I think this is an important conversation. What does that mean for organizers, progressives, progressive writers? So it was really a pleasure to speak with Pasha about this political moment in Canada today. And here is our conversation. So Pasha, your essays and writing sort of visit this intersection of, you know, personal reflection, societal commentary, and you wrote this piece that I read recently. We're speaking in 2025, but it was about an event in 2010 in Toronto, which was this summit of the G20, and thinking about the protests that happened, and you were sort of putting forth this idea that missing from the mainstream conversation was that there probably is something relevant and meaningful to consider in terms of the position and ideas that of corporate critique of inequality that the Black Bloc group, which is the direct action kind of components of those protests, were putting forth. I read this article and I was thinking about this time, and you know, as we're currently dealing with the rise of Poilievre and the Conservative Party, even though they didn't win the last election, they definitely were able to mobilize a lot of support. So I was thinking just to ask you, kind of in this current context, why thinking about that time when Harper was in power is kind of important to think about, to reflect on, and any sort of parallels or like lessons or ideas that you think we should consider in this current moment when the Conservatives have been able to sort of
create some sort of political coalition in Canada. I think it's important to talk about this. But so maybe any reflections on that? And if you could just first start by introducing yourself for our listeners. Thank you.
My name is Pasha. I'm a writer of fiction primarily. I've published three books of, I hesitate to call them poems because I'm not really a poet, but I try. I do a lot of nonfiction writing as well, or at least I used to. And these days I teach full-time at York University in the undergraduate program and also with some graduate students. And yeah, I mean, it was funny when you got in touch. I hadn't thought about that piece in a very long time. And then it started to kind of creep back into my brain recently, sort of thinking about ways in which I, as a writer, can participate in this conversation and be useful. And at the time, you know, that piece was, it was an attempt to write propaganda. I'll be like very honest. I was trying to use like the language of a kind of, you know, there are lines in that piece that make me cringe, but I was trying to use the language of a kind of like status quo, centrist, maybe center left, you know, Canadian citizen who might read The Walrus, who would think of, you know, anarchy, anarchism, black bloc, like as terrorism. And, you know, what I was trying to do is just be like, no, like they are articulating things that you are thinking. They're just using different strategies outside of this mainstream political apparatus that is fundamentally corrupt, broken, useless, I think, in many ways, and totally compromised by, you know, free market capitalism, political donation, like all kinds of like corporate malfeasance that's found its way into our politics. And I struggle a little bit with how the left has become preoccupied with symbols and symbolism. And I think that's something that I sort of maintain, that the sort of direct action when it happens in a symbolic way, like the smashing of a Starbucks or something, where there's like, you know, some 17-year-old kid making minimum wage cowering behind the counter. You know, like I struggle a little, like I understand the rage. I understand the need to do something when one feels like completely powerless. But, and I think these feelings have all been kind of returning to me. It's like, so what do we do? Like, what is to be done in this moment, like this moment of crisis, in which I think a lot of center-left Canadians feel like, you know, I feel like there's a sentiment that we've averted it, right? Like with this election of Mark Carney that, oh, don't worry, you know, the far right has kind of gone away in Canada. We're this bastion of, you know, sanity or whatever. And I find that thinking like deeply sinister. I mean, we tend to be one election cycle behind the States anyway. So, I mean, I think we can sort of think of Carney as kind of our Joe Biden, right? Like it's like while the far right gathers momentum, consolidates, like we have reverted to this, you know, status quo that is not working, right? Like it's not working for, I think most people. And it's certainly like not working for the planet. So it, you know, even before you got in touch with me about the piece, it was sort of like, I was kind of returning to these thoughts and thinking about ways to kind of address them in writing and, yeah, ways that I can be like useful, as someone who, you know, types sentences. I don't know if I can be useful in that way. Like, I think that there are people like, you know, Naomi Klein, and I mean, there are so many, Arundhati Roy, you know, so many incredible public figures who are writing brilliantly about this stuff. So yeah, just trying to like figure out what my position, I mean, I know my position, but I mean my position as far as a writer in relation to this stuff. So yeah, I was kind of going back to that idea of like my attempt to write a piece of propaganda, you know, anarchist propaganda in a mainstream publication. And that piece still makes me cringe a little bit, but, you know, the intentions were good. I'm not that good at that kind of writing. So it's a bit of a struggle. So yeah, I don't know. Like, yes, I think this stuff is, we need to be continuously talking about it. And not just spiraling around this idea of, you know, calling out fascism. But I think calling out the status quo and the Liberal Party for, you know, maintaining, you know, publicly, oh, you know, great, they're going to recognize the Palestinian state, but they, you know, there's still tons of arms going from Canada directly to the IDF. So, you know, we're not doing great. I think we're complicit in a lot of global evil still. And what happened with the NDP was dismaying. I hope it's going to spur some kind of groundswell in that party that will, you know, tilt the party back to the left, because I think it's been moving centrist as everything sort of tilts to the right.
So let's zero in on maybe a few different things that you highlighted. We could just talk a bit more about what you highlighted, which was this idea that the sort of neoliberal center can't be maintained, right? And I think a lot of people are struggling with this, right? Because you have the sort of symbolism of the very accurate intersectional critiques, at least in my opinion, of you know, probably tens of thousands of people between, you know, 20 years old and 45 years old who have largely not participated in the political system. And often these folks are really pretty sharp when it comes to sort of understanding the nuance of neoliberal politics and the challenges of and the hypocritical points that we face. I do think that talking about that a little bit more is important, right? Because you talked about this feeling that a crisis was averted. So maybe we could just look into that a bit more. Why do you feel like talking about the sort of contradictions of this moment with, you know, the Liberals in power and Carney and sort of the rising extreme right that is aligned with the Conservative Party? Just speak about this a bit more and why trying to like have more conversations about this is important.
Yeah, I mean, a really kind of an analogy I would cringe at if a student wrote it in one of my classes is like, I mean, if you imagine our politic as a kind of boat and the whole there's all this weight on the right, we're not going to steady the ship by sitting in the middle, right? Like it's got to swing to the left. I mean, otherwise we're going to be flooded with this tide of shit. It's difficult to have these conversations. I mean, I don't know if I should be saying this, but I just wrote a piece for the Globe and Mail. It was sort of nominally about Weird Al Yankovic, but what I wanted to talk about was like absurdism as a political strategy and as a political strategy that has traditionally been used by artists to like disarm fascism. It's just like when sense is no longer the common ground for political conversation, when things like, you know, basic human rights, empirical fact and truth no longer are the ways in which we relate to one another across the political spectrum, it's like, how do you engage with that, right? And I like how artists... absurdist artists, Dadaists, surrealists, you know, respond, you know, have this aestheticized politic that is like, okay, nothing makes sense. Here we are going to completely disrupt all the conventions of what we are supposed to be doing to respond to that. So I, you know, it's a stretch to position Weird Al as a political figure, but I wanted to talk about the stuff that we're talking about, like this kind of... this moment that we're in and the ineffectualness of, you know, a centrist neoliberal politic that is trying to engage with that in good faith, right? Like, it's like the presidential debates were, I mean, like a catastrophe. It was like the most, and that was where, you know, Weird Al sort of, the only political thing he's ever done is remix two of the presidential debates into original songs. Like, he stays away from politics entirely. So when there's this inherent absurdism to what's happening in the mainstream political sphere, like, I don't know how we engage with it other than to try and like completely disrupt it, right? To reveal this inherent nonsense of what's happening and this illusion of, you know, logic and causality and all these things that are no longer true. So, the Globe cut out all the stuff to do with Carney. I had two paragraphs talking about, you know, how centrist politics are incapable of, you know, meeting this stuff, because they're sort of, you know, they're using a system that is inherently broken, right? Like that, and that I think very few people have faith in anymore, which, you know, results in voter apathy on one side, and then this tilt to, like, you know, populist extremism on the right. So, I find it, you know, I approached this piece thinking like I was going to write something political, and I was like, oh, this is the Globe and Mail, right? Like, they will not, you know, rattle the cage at all. They're not interested in those kinds of conversations. So I was like, so what are the venues where, because I think we do need to reach that audience, right? Like that, you know, if there's a kind of central political identity to Canada, I would like to think that it's like center left, right? Maybe that's optimistic, you know, but I, you know, in the things that we cherish about this country as Canadians, you know, and I don't mean this in like a nationalistic kind of way, but I mean, I do like that I can go to the hospital, and that I don't have to pay money and I don't have to deal with private insurers. And there are many things about this country that I think the foundation of which are based in leftist principles, right? Like the things that make us a country are not far off from the things that make a lot of the Scandinavian countries, you know, or what they used to be, these kind of like, you know, socialist projects. So it's like, if these things are important to people who are voting liberal, can we have a conversation with those people that's like, yeah, but is this party, does this party represent those things at all anymore? Or is it just another arm of big business?
That was a highlight from a recent episode of Stefan Christoph's Free City Radio. Find new episodes wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. This episode is brought to you by the new Between the Lines Books release, Troubling Criminology. Find your copy at btlbooks.com. And finally, broadcasting since June 2023, Cyborg Goddess is a feminist tech studies podcast exploring topics like birth control, dating apps, gender confirmation surgery, and video games with host Dr. Jill Fellows on Vancouver Island. On this highlight from a new episode, Jill sits down with Dr. Nicole Ramsamer for a conversation exploring the illusion of convenience that artificial intelligence offers. Now, here's the show.
OpenAI released ChatGPT-3 to the general public at the end of 2022. And within 5 days of its release, it had over 1 million users. It's fair to say that today, 3 years later, ChatGPT and other large language models embedded in Google, Bing, Facebook, Snapchat, Adobe, and, well, everywhere, have become ubiquitous. They promise to increase our abilities and capacities in a whole host of ways. But what they promise most is convenience. And convenience always comes with a cost. So welcome to another episode of Cyborg Goddess. I'm your host, Jennifer Jill Fellows. Today, my guest is Dr. Nicole Ramsamer, and she is going to help me answer the question of what the convenience of large language models are costing us. Dr. Nicole Ramsamer is an assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy at Dalhousie University. She defines herself as an academic and a mom who worked through 24-hour workdays to complete her PhD while raising two young children. Her research interests include applied ethics, social and political philosophy, feminist philosophy, and personal identity. and she has a special interest in freedom of expression. Today, Nicole is here to talk about her research work on generative AI technologies and epistemic injustice. Hi, Nicole. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm joining from Halifax, Nova Scotia, in the Mi'kma'ki and the traditional unceded territory of the Mi'kmaq people.
Wonderful. So. I would also like to invite my listeners to think about physical space required to sustain this digital podcast. The servers and cables that connect myself and Nicole today are built with material extracted from stolen land and occupy stolen land. They depend on water for cooling and energy to keep working. Our digital tools and lives are not separate from physical reality and increasingly exert an immense pressure on physical space in ways that are often hidden from the user. So to make that hidden space somewhat less hidden, I acknowledge that this podcast is recorded on the unceded territories of the Coast Salish people, including the territories of the Katsi, Kwantlen, Musqueam, Kikhite, Squamish, Tsawin, and Tsleil-Waututh nations. So, Nicole, can you tell me how you became interested in pursuing a PhD in philosophy?
Generally, my story is pretty typical as I took philosophy back in high school, and I honestly just never stopped. I always thought that I'll just keep on going until something stops, and unfortunately, I haven't had to stop yet, so I keep on it.
That's so cool. Not all high schools offer philosophy courses, but I think that it's really cool when a high school can do that, whether people continue on or not. Like, obviously, I'm biased, but a little background in philosophy, I think, is always a good thing. And obviously, it hooked you.
Yeah, I think my first paper was on the existence of God. And I really enjoyed that one.
That's awesome. And so you went ahead and did a bachelor's degree. Was it in philosophy directly?
I did a bachelor in English and philosophy. I think I wanted to teach high school. And
then you were still hooked, so you kept going?
Yeah. I thought, yeah, it's just a year for a master's, might as well. And then I just kept on going after that, so.
All right, cool. So you've been hooked since high school, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. I feel like when I was in high school, I didn't even know what philosophy was. So I think that's awesome. But more recently, you've become interested in exploring large language generative AI models. So probably the most familiar one for a lot of users would be either the Snapchat AI or ChatGPT or something like that. So how did you become interested in examining these generative AI models from an epistemological perspective?
Well, I think it was actually a couple of years ago I started thinking about personalization and autonomy and how those two function together. And even before we had ChatGPT, we were seeing more and more of this personalization going into these little rabbit holes of echo chambers where you don't get really exposed to much else, that your advertisements are personalized, the music's personalized, what you watch is personalized. And I had started thinking about that for a little while, but then when ChatGPT came around, I was starting to see it used as a sort of resource for knowledge, and that I found a little concerning because it's one particular avenue in which persons can go. And yeah, it seems to be that kind of personalization to the extreme in these cases.
Right.
Yeah.
So we already had, and you're right, like if we think about just kind of the algorithmic setup of a lot of our internet tools and apps and things like that, we already had fairly strong personalization happening, even for other sites where people might go for knowledge. So, you know, like, before generative AI, a lot of my students would like Google the answer, even if they weren't supposed to. Or you might ask Siri or Alexa to find something for you. So you're using them not just for entertainment or for other reasons, but also to gather knowledge. And it does become personalized, right? So if you Google an answer from a different geographic location, for example, you might get a different result. And your history, your search history is also supposed to play into that, although obviously this is all proprietary. So we're trying to figure it out kind of from our end, from the user end, rather than necessarily knowing what goes into the back end. I think that's really interesting, though. And you referenced echo chambers there and the relationship between personalization and echo chambers. And we're going to talk about that more, I think, as we get into the conversation today. But yeah, so we have now ChatGPT, which was increasingly being used as a knowledge tool, as you said, and then large language model generative AI
resources are also being put into other areas that we're already accustomed to thinking of as knowledge areas, whether we should or not. So now when you Google something, for example, the very first hit is the AI generated answer, right?
Yeah.
And then there's stuff that paid to be on the front page, and then there's all the other stuff. So I think that's really interesting, is the idea of looking at this as not necessarily a tool for knowledge, but as something that's being used as a tool for knowledge, or being maybe framed as a tool for knowledge. Is that the right way of thinking about it?
Yeah, I think it being framed as a tool for knowledge, or just even the convenience of it. It's just a convenient, quick way to, you don't even have to click a website anywhere, as you said, but the generative answer you see right up at the top, that you don't even have to look through an entire page. It's just seems that it's a means of obtaining knowledge in a way that just seems a little too convenient.
And then there is this personalization aspect that can divide us, right? Because the answer I get might be different from the answer that someone else gets from a different geographic location, or based on their search history or other tracking data on the way. Yeah, and that's before we talk about the personalized ads, which you did kind of talk about briefly. Just even the content that you're getting can be very specific. Mm-hmm.
As a highlight from a new episode of Cyborg Goddess. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode has been brought to you by the new Between the Lines books release, Troubling Criminology, by Michael C.K. Ma and Mike Larson. Find a copy at btlbooks.com. And by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's coalition of more than 30 progressive publishers and get all your independent Canadian journalism, including news, videos, and podcasts, in one place at unrigged.ca. On Twitter at Harbinger Tweets and on Instagram at Media Harbinger, and now on Blue Sky and Substack for updates on new episodes. And subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 83 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
But the echo chamber doesn't necessarily always have to be with other persons. I think this sort of personalization goes hand in hand as well. That if we're constantly exposed to only what we want to be exposed to, or what the algorithm thinks that we are going to be exposed to, we're not... It, as I said, it's in music, it's in our searches, it's in our entertainment. Everything has a sort of personalized feature to it. So we're constantly going to be exposed to the same sorts of ideas.
Hi, this is Towers, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC. Diverse, independent, yours.
This is Bird Note. And this is a sagebrush sparrow singing from atop a big sagebrush. As their name suggests, sagebrush sparrows live in dry, open shrublands. They winter in the desert southwest and migrate as far north as central Washington to breed each spring. About the size of a junco, sagebrush sparrows are dressed in soft grays and browns. You'll often spot these dapper birds singing from a high perch, making it easy to view the distinctive patch of dark feathers at the center of their otherwise white breast. Performance complete, the little bird hops back to the ground to forage for seeds and bugs with his flock. Look for them running rapidly about, with tails cocked up like scampering chipmunks. The sparrow's plaintive song seems to convey a sense of their precarious future in the West. Sagebrush sparrow populations have declined by more than 50% since 1970, largely due to habitat loss from urbanization, agricultural conversion, and wildfires. To support our remaining sagebrush sparrows, we have to protect the landscapes they call home. Learn more about sagebrush conservation at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.